This is lecture number 7, Patriarchal Life, part 1, the Ancient Israel class. We're going to begin the closer examination of the lives of the patriarchs to see the way they lived that life in terms of their social and religious customs and how it fits into the milieu of the second millennium B.C., the period from approximately 2000 B.C., to around 1800 B.C., which would be the time of the patriarchs. Now, one very important aspect of the lifestyle was the nature of the patriarchal household. We even use the word patriarch today in much the same way that it was used in ancient times. We speak about somebody being a patriarch because he has authority over a very large group of people, a very large establishment. And as you can see on the chart that we have on the slide, you have the patriarch, and under his authority, you have his wife or wives, as the case might be. Why is the word son repeated twice? What is the reason for that? What do you deduce from what you see? No, it doesn't label him as that. In fact, there is no special firstborn inheritance right. It is whomever the patriarch chooses to receive the birthright receives it. He's not bound to the firstborn. That's a later custom in ancient Israel where the firstborn gets it by right of being the firstborn. In this period, it's something that can be altered at the patriarch's desire. There's another reason why son is mentioned twice. Ronnie?
What is the son of a handmaid?
You're making an assumption which is not called for. I think just using the information that's provided, you can see something that makes them different without worrying about anything else. Martin?
One's married and one's unmarried.
Yes, one is married and one is not married. Now, the reason for that is to show you that not only is the unmarried son under the patriarch's authority, but the married son with his wife and his children is also under the authority of the patriarch. And we use this fact as one of the things we use in analyzing the relationship between Jacob and Laban, is that Jacob, while he was married and had children, never established his own household as long as he lived with Laban. He always lived with Laban. He was under his authority, which again creates a lot of the circumstantial evidence for the idea that Jacob was a son to Laban, not a son-in-law. A wife joins her husband's family in this period, the patriarchal period we're talking about. A son does not join his wife's family, even if he's far from home. This is not the norm. But married sons, as long as they are in the same geographic area as their father, they remain under the authority of their father. And remember, as with the case of Laban and Jacob, everything that the son owns is the property legally of his father. It is not his. Notice we only have one daughter listed here. What is her status? Married, unmarried? Unmarried. Once a daughter marries, she leaves the authority of her father and comes under the authority of her husband's father. Women are never on their own authority in this period. They're always under the authority of somebody. Now, this would complete the family as we might construe it today. And if we allow for the married son, wife, and children as being under the family structure, we would call it today an extended family, because you have grandfather and father and children living in the same household, the grandfather's house. But the patriarchal family was different from our even modern extended family in two major respects. Servants and the children of servants and slaves are considered part of the family. They're not just under the authority of the patriarch, they are parts of the family. That's why Eliezer was considered to be a closer relative to Abraham even though he was a slave in Abraham's household, who was born in Abraham's household, than Lot, who represented a separate household and had been, you know, his blood nephew. You'll notice, too, that while Lot dwelt with Abraham, he was under Abraham's authority. That when there was strife between Lot's shepherds and Abraham's, Abraham had every right to insist that his shepherds have the priority. Lot was under his authority. But being a very generous man, a very giving person, he said, look, there's problems. We've both grown very large. It's not really practical for any longer for us to remain part of one household. I give you permission to separate. And you may, of course, take that which is yours with you. And in fact, I'll let you choose first where you will go to settle, and I will go the other direction. Now, it was very gracious and giving of Abraham, because by right as patriarch, he had the right to just put Lot's shepherds down if he wanted to, or if he allowed the separation, to make the first choice as to where he would settle and leave the other possibilities for Lot to figure out. So it's very interesting in how he treated Lot. Even though he had the right to take the priority, he gave him the priority. Also, something that's very unusual for considering as members of the family, the animals. The animals are considered members of the family. They're not just part of the household, they're members of the family, in the same way as the people are. And this relates to what we saw, I think, in the very first lecture, dealing with Jonah being in Nineveh, where the king of Nineveh declared a community-wide fast, and of course the animals were expected to fast as well. This is just the way they looked at things even much later. Even today in the Middle East, I am told, since I've not traveled heavily in Arab areas, but I'm told by people who have, that if you go into an Arab village and you ask them what is the population of this village, they will give you, if they know it, the number of inhabitants, human and animals. They wouldn't think to leave the animals out because that's part of the community in their way of reckoning. And so you see that tradition is still held. So here we have the patriarch's family. Patriarch, his wife or wives, unmarried sons, married sons with their wives and children, unmarried daughters, servants and slaves and their children, and the animals. They're all under his authority. Now what happens... Yes, David.
Now, since servants are considered part of the family, does that mean they aren't given wages?
Okay, servants as opposed to slaves.
Right.
Servants are paid wages, yes.
Can they... leave and
with, well, with the patriarch's permission, yes, they can go elsewhere. Usually in this day and age, they wouldn't have thought to do so. If it was a well-to-do household and they were paid generously and treated generously, they wouldn't think to go anywhere else. They identify very strongly with the household. In the same way that in other cultures, many times slaves identified very strongly with their masters and would have given gladly their lives for them if required. It was just a sense of devotion to them. Good question, though.
In not understanding the son and the wife under the patriarch's control, where does that come in line with God telling the husband to leave his father and mother?
Okay. At the time when God spoke to Adam, you did not yet have this social system. This is the social system that developed later. Now, in ancient Israel, once they were established as a nation coming out of Sinai, they had a totally different setup. When a son married, he formed his own household. That system changed again. That's another way we can see that there are differences between what we read in the patriarchal narratives and what we see in later Israel that proves they didn't take the customs of later Israel and just throw them back into the lives of the patriarchs. There are too many differences. We're going to see them not only in the social structure, but the pattern of inheritance. We'll see it also in the case of religious customs, that there are many major differences in the way the patriarchs lived as opposed to later Israel. Okay, question. This is a setup. What happens when the patriarch dies? Now, very different answer than what is true of later Israel. In this case, in the patriarchal period, one of the sons, the expectation would be it would be normally the oldest, but it doesn't have to be. the son designated by the patriarch becomes the new patriarch, and everything remains as it was before. The son is now the patriarch, but he is an authority not only over his own wife and children, but he is an authority over his brothers, his sisters-in-law, and their children, and he is an authority over his sisters who are unmarried. He is an authority, of course, over the servants and slaves and their children, and an authority over the animals. The unit does not break up on the death of the patriarch. It remains intact, with one of the sons simply replacing his father as the person in charge. Now, there are two ways this can change, where the other sons acquire, quote, freedom to be their own patriarch. And they are as follows. One, the patriarch may choose to send his other sons away while he is still alive. And since he is in charge, he can gift them with whatever of his substance he chooses. Because he leaves everything kit and caboodle, lock, stock, and barrel, to whoever will replace him as the new patriarch. There is no division of the inheritance. Everything goes to the person who becomes the new patriarch. So if he wants to provide something specifically for his other sons as their unique inheritance, he has to give it to them while he is still alive, but that's not enough. Because even if he gives it to them, it's still his legally, and therefore passes to his heir and becomes his legally. He has to send them away, out of the area. Once they're out of the physical proximity to the family unit, they are entitled to become the heads of their own household and the absolute owners of whatever property they have. Now, do we have any biblical example of that? Of a patriarch sending away some of his sons with gifts he has chosen for them, so that they can become their own masters and not be under the authority of their brother. Mr. Gardner. Yes, the sons of Keturah. Genesis chapter 25. This explains why Abraham did this. It wasn't so that they would be to avoid the problem of them being in competition with Isaac. In these days, the idea of competition in the patriarchal household, it just didn't occur to people. As long as you're part of the household, you accept the authority in it. You don't fight against it. There wouldn't have been any squabbling or competition. But after Sarah had died, Abraham took a wife, and her name was Keturah, and she bore him these sons, and then he sent them away with gifts that he had chosen. With gifts that he had chosen. Now, apparently, the status of this new wife was not a full wife. The status of this individual and some others that are not named were that of concubines. Now, a man could enter into a marriage and make the woman a wife, or he could enter into a relationship and make her a concubine. That was his choice. That meant she was less than a full wife. In this case, Keturah is the only one named, and the others are unnamed. But while he was yet alive, he sent them eastward away from Isaac with the gifts that he had chosen for them. This is the only way he could be sure that they would have the absolute authority over that inheritance and they would be able to establish their own households and learn the lessons, you know, that come with that type of responsibility. And so this is why he did it. Now, undoubtedly, God also was in this because they were not to be among those who would inherit the land of Canaan. They were to have an inheritance somewhere else. So obviously this is not just on Abraham's own thought. God, it was also in it. Now, this also explains the blessing that Jacob extorted by deception from his father Isaac. If you look at the wording, when he comes in with what is supposedly venison, but is really that goat prepared by his mother, with the skins of the goats on him so he looks hairy and can be seen to be hairy like his brother Esau, Isaac eats and thinks it really is Esau, even though it sounded like Jacob, and he gives him the blessing. Now notice what he says. In verse 28 of chapter 27, Genesis 27, verse 28, "Therefore may God give you of the dew of heaven, of the fatness of the earth, and plenty of grain and wine." He's asking for God to give him material blessings. "Let peoples serve you, and nations bow down to you. Be master over your brethren. Let your mother's sons bow down to you." You see? This is a ritualistic formula being employed. That by inheriting the birthright and blessing, Jacob then acquires the right, after his father dies, to become the new patriarchal head and have the responsibility and authority over all the other members of the household. This is putting Esau under Jacob in terms of authority when Isaac dies. But of course, Isaac thought he was blessing Esau and putting Jacob under Esau. It was really the reverse, because he was blessing the wrong man. Now, later on, when Jacob returns from Haran, Esau is no longer living at home. He is living in a location called Mount Seir. And he comes to meet Jacob, and Jacob, of course, is afraid, and he sends him many rich gifts, hoping to placate his anger. And then he meets him, and he's kind of fearful of the meeting. But Esau is not in a mood to be, you know, vengeful. He has acquired a new homeland. He has been prospered in that homeland. He has plenty of his own. He even returns the gifts that Jacob has given him because he doesn't need it. He has plenty, more than enough, you see. Now, how does he get to Mount Seir? Well, obviously, the only way a son can leave the household is with his father's permission. Isaac, expecting that God would bring Jacob back to his lawful inheritance, well, inheritance that he had secured unlawfully, but which God intended him to have all along, did not like the idea of Esau having to live under Jacob's authority, and so he allowed him to leave with a gift appropriate to him, and he went over to what is now the area of Edom, called Mount Seir at that time, and he established himself there. That's how he got to be separate. So this is the way these things were carried on. If Esau had not moved away with his father's permission, then he would have remained under Jacob's authority. Remember, too, that when Jacob wanted to flee from home because he feared that Esau would kill him after he had stolen the birthright and blessing. Well, not the birthright, he had stolen the blessing. He already bought the birthright, he had stolen the blessing that passed on the patriarchal authority. He couldn't just get up and go and leave a note. "Dad, I went up to Haran to get a wife from the same place you got one." He couldn't do that. He had to go to his father, make a request, and then be given permission to depart. This is the way things function. Son did not leave the household without his father's permission. Yes?
Could you define the difference between the birthright and the blessing?
Okay, the birthright is the right to receive the property of the patriarch. The blessing is distinguished from that as being the right to the patriarchal authority. They go together, but they are separate things. That's why Esau said, "He not only has cheated me of my birthright, but now he has taken my blessing also." In other words, Esau sold the birthright, the right to the inheritance of the goods, but he expected to have the lordship in the family, which is an unusual way of separating the two, because they almost always went together. Notice I'm showing you here again Genesis 25, verses 5 and 6, where he says that Abraham gave all he had to Isaac, but to the sons of the concubines which he had, he gave gifts and sent them away from Isaac, his son, while he yet lived, while he had the authority to do this. Okay, let us turn to another area, that of religion. In the matters of religion, you have a situation that is almost like a patriarchal setup. Instead of the patriarch, however, at the top, you have the god who is worshipped by the family in that position. And under the god, you have the patriarch. And then, of course, under the patriarch, you have his whole family. And I'm using the term family in the wide sense in which it was used in this period. That there was a special covenant relationship between the patriarch and his God. Special covenant relationship between the patriarch and his God. Now, this is shown to us in a number of scriptures. For instance, Genesis 31, I'll just give you one example of this particular covenant relationship. Genesis 31 shows us a situation when Laban and Jacob separate for the last time. Remember, Jacob stole away, didn't tell Laban he was going, and then Laban caught up with him. And after they'd had their discussion, they ended up having making a covenant with each other. And how did they seal the covenant? Notice how they sealed it. Genesis 31, verse 49. We'll start reading here so we get the terms of the covenant. May the eternal watch between you and me when we are absent from one another. Notice right away, how many gods are being invoked in this covenant? What does the text say?
One.
May the eternal. They both are worshippers of the same God, Laban and Jacob. May the eternal watch between you and me when we are absent from one another. If you afflict my daughters, or if you take other wives besides my daughters, although no man is with us, in other words, I don't have a representative who will know about it by being there to watch you, God is witness between you and me. You know, let God be the one who observes and catches you in it. Then Laban said to Jacob, here is this heap and here is this pillar which I have placed between you and me. Let this heap be witness and this pillar a witness that I will not pass beyond this heap to you, and you will not pass beyond this heap and this pillar to me for harm. In other words, this is going to be a boundary between the two of us. I will not cross this boundary to do you any harm, to take any of your property, and you will not come back across this boundary to do any harm to me or my sons and our property. This is a boundary between us. But then notice how it is concluded. The God of Abraham, the God of Nahor, and the God of their father judge between us. How many gods are being invoked? One. One God, the same one. But it is invoked in the name of the patriarch who is Jacob's forebear, Abraham, and who is Laban's forebear. Because notice, Laban, his father was who? Remember, Laban and Rebekah are brother and sister. Who was their father? Do you remember from Genesis 24 when Eliezer was doing the wheeling and dealing about Rebekah? Who was the guy that got no gifts and doesn't seem to get to say much except as an adjunct to Laban? What was his name? Bethuel. Laban's father is Bethuel, but his grandfather is Nahor. Jacob's grandfather is Abraham, you see? The clan figure who had the established relationship is one who was employed. In other words, it's the same God, because it's in the context of this whole covenant, which it only mentions one God. But they are called by the unique clan name. Just like Abraham used many different names for God in different places. He always meant the same one. Just called them by different characteristics. The Almighty, the God Most High, the God who will see and provide. He spoke about different characteristics of God, but he always was worshiping the same one. There was never any confusion in his mind that he was worshiping several. He knew he was only worshiping one. Same way, there's only one God here, but he is referred to by both of the clan names, the God of Abraham and the God of Nahor. You may remember that when Eliezer goes up and has to deal with Abraham's relations for Rebekah, he says, the God of Abraham, my master. You see, that's the proper way of referring to it. The relationship is between the patriarch and his God, and so he's the God of Abraham. That's the way he refers to him. Because of this way this was seen, where the God had this special relationship with the patriarch. Now, Jacob swore by the pachad of his father Isaac. Literally translated, pachad is fear. But it seems rather a peculiar aphorism, and some do translate it as shield or protector, some versions, because they just don't know what to do. It's not the common word for shield, which is magan, but they don't know exactly why that particular term, pachad, is used here, and they doubt it really should be literally translated, because it doesn't seem to make a whole lot of sense. But that is the unique name under which Isaac had a relationship with God. So it's brought in by Jacob directly as they acknowledge the various clan names for their God, which is the same God. Notice that in a patriarchal household, you did not have a religious democracy. There was no freedom of conscience, of religious conscience within the family. The patriarch worshipped a given God. Everyone in the family was expected to do likewise. It was unthinkable to be any other way. The patriarch, once he exercised a choice and said, this is the God of the family, everybody says, fine. That's the one we worship. That's why Eliezer is just a slave of Abraham, and yet he worships Abraham's God. It's why Ishmael grows up worshiping Abraham's God. It's why Esau grows up worshiping Isaac's God. It's just that since God did not intend to work his plan through the descendants of Ishmael, within a few generations, Ishmael's descendants forgot the God of Abraham. God did not actively work to perpetuate contact with them and awareness of him, as he did work to keep it in the minds of the descendants of Isaac. In the same way with Esau. Esau's descendants, within a short time, were not worshippers of the true God. Even Lot, righteous Lot, who was a patriarch in his own right now, and was called in the New Testament, is called, you know, righteous Lot, was a worshipper of the true God. His children, grandchildren, I don't know what to call them, since they were his sons by his daughters. Remember when they committed incest with him after the destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah? They were worried that nobody would marry them because they were like plague bearers or something, the only ones to escape the destruction. So they got him drunk and had relations with him so they would have children. While these descendants became the ancestors of Moab and Ammon, they did not perpetuate the knowledge of the true God. The knowledge of the true God existed up in Rebekah's family. But already idolatrous mixing is mixing in the days of Laban and Rachel and Leah. And after probably another generation, again, it was gone. Because God was not working through that line. He was separating out a line to perpetuate the knowledge of his worship. But a patriarch had the absolute authority. Now, again, Jacob, while he was with Laban, if we allow the idea that was planted a couple of times ago, that he was a son of Laban. He had no choice as to what would be worshipped in the household. Now, fortunately, Laban worshipped the true God, so he had no great conflict there. But he also was mixing a lot of idolatry, too, apparently. How do we know that? What's the proof that we know that Laban's household mixed some idolatrous things in with the worship of the true God? It's Paul?
Because back in chapter 31, whenever Jacob and his wife left, and Rachel stole some of the images, some of the gods of Laban.
Right. Now, it has been stated by some scholars that the images that Rachel stole, the household gods that Rachel stole from her father's house, they were not there in the capacity of being images of worship, but they were simply the traditional tokens of inheritance that existed in all families, and therefore they were used that way without their worship aspect. In the same way you might have a statue of Buddha in your garden and not use it as an object of meditation or worship, but just as a decorative piece, you see. Or you might have, like I do in my office, I have a statue of Horus, the Egyptian god. Horus and one of the Toltec rain god as well. I think I got lost the Minerva. No, I still have a representation of Minerva also. Now, they're decorative items. I'm not keeping them as idols to worship, and I don't lay offerings in front of them and bow before them. You see, they're just decorative pieces. It has been suggested that that's what these idols were in Laban's household. But that seems very doubtful for another reason. And that is, remember, Jacob leaves with not only his wives and children and his animals, but those servants he has acquired, which technically also belong to Laban. He takes off with all of them. Then after they've had this covenant with Laban and they continue to move into Canaan, they come to Shechem, and they settle down in the vicinity of Shechem. We have in the beginning of Genesis 35, God speaking to Jacob and commanding him that he should leave the area of Shechem and go to Bethel and dwell there and make an altar there to God who appeared to you when you fled from the face of Esau your brother. Remember when he left Beersheba going up to Haran, he stopped overnight at Bethel. He slept there. He had a vision of the ladder with the angels going up and down. And he dedicated the pillar, the stone that he had slept on, and made a covenant with God that if God would be with him, he would worship this God, if he would prosper him and bring him home again. Well, God is now speaking to him, telling him to go back to Bethel and build an altar there. Now, he's going to build an altar and formally acknowledge this God as his God. Because what he asked this God to do, he has done. Remember the peculiar way he phrased his prayer? If you are with me in all the places I go, and if you protect me, and if you prosper me, and if you bring me back again, then you will be my God, and I will pay the tithe to you. Not exactly a converted attitude when he made that prayer when he was leaving. He was still a very devious individual. He got his just deserts because Laban deceived him better than he'd ever deceived anybody in his life. It's interesting how poetic justice comes in there. But now he has come back. God has fulfilled his part of the covenant, even though it was stated in a very poor way. God chose for his own reasons to fulfill it. And now he says, okay, you see, I fulfilled it. I want you to enter into relationship with me. So go to Bethel and make an altar there and let's seal it. And Jacob is willing to do it. That means that God will be the only one worshipped in the household. What does he say? Jacob said to his household, to all who were with him, put away the foreign gods that are among you. Purify yourselves and change your garments. And let us arise and go up to Bethel, and I will make an altar there to God, who answered me in the day of my distress and has been with me in the way which I have gone. Now, there were no complaints. It just simply says, they gave Jacob all the foreign gods which were in their hands and all their earrings which were in their ears. There must have been something idolatrous about that that we don't quite understand. And Jacob hid them under a terebinth tree which was by Shechem. They surrendered their foreign objects. That again shows you that Laban had allowed that. Remember, all these servants were Jacob's, but they were part of Laban's household. And they had all these foreign gods. Laban had allowed it, so it must have been something he had in his own household. Shows you there was a mixture of the worship of God and idolatry in Laban's household. The knowledge of the sole worship of God was beginning to be compromised. And pretty soon it would die out and not be there anymore. But now, Jacob is his own boss. He is officially separated from Laban, with Laban's consent even. Of course, God made sure the consent was given. Didn't leave Laban any choice. Spoke to him in the dream the night before and said, don't be careful what you say to my servant Jacob. Otherwise, I'll give it to you. So Laban decides, well, in those circumstances, I'll be very generous. And I'll let Jacob know how generous I'm being here. Can't resist that, you know. Even though he didn't have a choice, he has to make Jacob feel that he's being willingly generous. And so Jacob is now entitled to be his own patriarch, entitled to own these possessions, and therefore to set the religious policy for his household. First time he has that authority. While he lived with Laban, he couldn't do it, even for his own servants. It wasn't his responsibility or authority to do it. Okay, let's go on and take a look at the actual worship. Very common in Canaanite times, in this period of the patriarch, to have cult centers. cult centers, places where the various gods were worshipped. Now let's say each of these standing stones that we see in this slide, and to give you an idea of how big they are, we can look at this one. Oh my. Believe it or not, this is my daughter. But she's a lot bigger now. Each of these standing stones was a representation of a different god. People in the community knew which one was for which. They didn't get them confused. Let's say you were going to worship all five of them. You would then go to the altar that would stand in front of each monolith and do something at each altar in turn. Let's say you were just going to worship one. Then you would go to the altar that was associated with the particular monolith, or masaba, as it's called in Hebrew. And you would do your thing at that altar and then leave. Sort of like today in modern cities, it frequently is the case in modern cities and towns that certain areas are zoned for churches. And so you will see a lot of churches within a very short distance of each other. This was sort of like the church zone. You know, the different gods each had their own place here. This was the place, the holy soil, where gods could be worshipped. This is why the text, if it's properly understood in the sense of the Hebrew, says about Abraham in chapter 12, when he came to Shechem, that it says in chapter 12, verse 6, that Abraham passed through the land to the place at Shechem. Remember I mentioned in the biblical geography class that that pronoun, rather that preposition of, should really be at. The place at Shechem. Now what was that place at Shechem? The place where the terebinth tree of Moreh was. That was where the people of that area worshipped. Now, it says in my text, terebinth, and others, I think, translate it as oak. I think the Jewish translation uses oak. There was an oak at Moreh, which was the place where people worshipped. It was not uncommon for a tree to be set up at the place which was established as a place of worship. Abraham had no hang-ups about using that place. One thing he didn't do, however, he didn't use their altar, any of their altars, because you notice what it says. That he built an altar to the Eternal, in verse 7. He built his own altar, because he was not worshiping one of their gods. So he wasn't going to use one of their altars. He built his own. Everywhere where it talks about the patriarchs worshiping God, where sacrifice presumably was involved, they build their own altars. Even if they're at an established holy place, they build their own altars. Genesis chapter 26, verse 25, gives us something that may give you some of the horrors when you read it. It shouldn't. Back up to verse 24. The Eternal appeared to him, meaning Abraham, the same night. I'm sorry, Isaac. This is Isaac in this case. The Eternal appeared to him the same night and said, I am the God of your father Abraham. Do not fear, for I am with you. I will bless you and multiply your descendants for my servant Abraham's sake. Verse 25. So he built an altar there and called on the name of the Eternal, and he pitched his tent there, and there Isaac's servants dug a well. Now, you go on and you see that here in Beersheba, he builds his own altar, but I've got the wrong place. This wasn't the place I had meant here. I'm sorry. That's why I assumed it was Abraham, because what I was looking for was Abraham at Beersheba. It's interesting to see what he does. Let's go back to chapter 12. It may be there. Because it's either there when he first comes to Beersheba or when he comes back after having been in Egypt. I had in my notes chapter 26, and that was a mistake. No, I'm sorry, it's not there. Let's see. 13, I'm going to have to just search for it now. If I can find it. Otherwise, I'll have to give you the reference next time. Let's take a look there. No, he's at Beersheba at that time. I'll have to look at it, but it mentions that Abraham planted, it says in the Old King James, a grove. Hara of Haras. Abraham planted a grove by his altar at Beersheba. Now, I'll have to find the reference because I can't seem to find it. Yes?
21, 31, 32, 33.
Okay, sharp-eyed. This is after he swears the oath with Abimelech that gives Abraham the right of possession at Beersheba. It says that after they made this oath, verse 33, Abraham planted a tamarisk tree in Beersheba, and there called on the name of the Eternal, the Everlasting God. Obviously associated together. It's not just, well, he wanted some shade, so he built a tree, and after he built the tree, he then started to pray to God. No, the two are linked. It's a religious act, the planting of the tamarisk tree. The original King James, where it says grove, it's not the best translation of the term. Tamarisk tree is probably correct. Because a tree typically marked a holy spot. This is a way it was frequently, the demarcation of a holy spot was to plant a tree there. Obviously, there is no idolatrous connection. Why then was Israel later forbidden to do the same thing? The answer is because by the time Israel became a nation, after they came out of Egypt, this had acquired so many idolatrous connotations that God just didn't think Israel should have anything to do with it. It would be too confusing for them to get that close to the worship of the other people. When he was dealing with Abraham as an individual, he wasn't worried about it. And so therefore he didn't prohibit him from using the typical custom of the day. In the same way, if you think about our worship services, are they really all that different from the typical Protestant service? We stand, we sing hymns, we have a prayer, we have a lesson out of the scriptures, though we do it, of course, much more in depth than is typical in most services, and the sermon is directly related to the scripture than a person's philosophy of life. Thankfully, it is again that way in God's church. For a short time, it wasn't always that way. But, and then we have, a final hymn. I mean, it's really not all that different. But does that make it pagan? No. Any more than the use of the tamarisk tree to mark the holy spot where Abraham had established a place for the worship of his God was pagan, simply because it was also done by the pagans. Something is pagan in the wrong sense, in the sense of being idolatrous, when it perverts something of God to a wrong use or directs it to the wrong being, then it is idolatrous. Just because it's similar doesn't make it automatically idolatrous. Just because it is pagan in origin doesn't make it idolatrous automatically. Okay, let me hope that the next reference is correct, and I haven't goofed that one here. I better make the change in my notes. You said that was 21, verse, was it 31? 33. Thank you. Let's try chapter 33, verse 19. Yes. Beginning in verse 19, this is Jacob at Shechem. He bought the parcel of land where he had pitched his tent from the children of Hamor, Shechem's father, for 100 pieces of money. Then he erected an altar there and called it El Elohei Yisrael. Now, again, he didn't worship at an altar that these pagan peoples were using. He has his own altar, and El Elohei Yisrael is really just El, the God of Israel. El is being used as a proper name. El is also the general term for God, pagan or true. But El is being used as a proper name in this particular scripture. El, the God of Israel, meaning himself, because he is now named Israel after his wrestling match. Okay. Modern critical scholarship in the late 19th, early 20th century insisted that the patriarchs worshipped only one God. But not all patriarchs worship the same one. or that though they worshiped one God, they did believe others existed. It's just that they were bound to worship only one of the many possibilities. Now, what is the difference? There's a term that describes this. Monotheism is the belief there is only one God. But when you believe there are many, but you choose to worship only one, there's a special term for that. That is called monolatry. Monolatry. M-O-N-O, mono, L-A-T-R-Y. The worship of one God while admitting the existence of others. This is what the modern critical scholars came up with in the late 19th, early 20th century, and I think there are some modern critical scholars who still believe it. That each patriarch worshipped a different single God, and only the later traditions of Israel made them worshipping the same one. And they admitted that others existed and just chose to worship one. Now let's just deal with the first part, because the second would be hard to prove one way or the other. Let's just deal with the first idea, that each patriarch worshipped a different God. What I'd like you to do for next time is to see how you would rebut that using the scriptures. They claimed that that was the case because they called God by different names. The names Jacob calls God are not the names Isaac uses, which are not the names Abraham used. So therefore, they were worshipping different gods. How would you rebut that? Okay? Using the scriptures, see what you can come up with, and we'll start with that next time.